A new study was released this week from the American College of Cardiology. It's projecting a very steep rise in all four cardiovascular risk factors for the years 2025 to 2060, which is not too far away from us. So to give us some perspective on this and understand this study and what it means for you a little bit better, we have cardiologist Dr. Elizabeth Clotus here, who is an expert source in discussing this study, the risk factors and solutions. She is also the founder of what's called Step One Foods, which essentially is a program that is a nutrition-based scientific approach to better care for your heart health. Joining us right now is Dr. Clotus. Thank you so much for being here. How are you?
Oh, thanks so much for having me. I'm doing great. Just got through a storm in Minnesota. So.
Oh, boy. Well, we're so glad that you could be here with us this morning. Tell us a little bit about this study. Where did it kind of come about? And what are some of the alarming key factors in it that you want people to know?
Yeah, so this was, you know, basically combining two sets of data. One is the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey, which is an ongoing evaluation of the health of the U.S. population. And that was layered upon U.S. Census data that looks at, you know, the demographics as they are and as they are projected to be in the future. And when you combine these two pieces of population data, what you saw is that we are facing a tsunami of heart disease and heart disease risk factors. So we are going to see, you know, 30%+ increases in diabetes, in high blood pressure, in high cholesterol, and then that all translates into increases in rates of stroke and heart attacks and chronic heart disease and heart failure. This is completely unsustainable.
So I just heard you say, doctor, that we are facing essentially a storm of heart disease and risk factors across the country. Why is that? Like, what triggered the huge uptick in these risk factors and just heart disease in general?
You know, if you look at the four major risk factors that are outlined in this study, so high cholesterol, high blood pressure, diabetes or high blood sugar, and obesity and excess weight, if you think about what is the common thread across all of those, it's food. Every single one of those is caused in part or in whole by food. Yet this is not how we approach health and healing, right? High cholesterol, here's a pill. High blood pressure, here's two pills. So we are, you know, very busy mopping up, you know, water on the floor, inventing, you know, more and more absorbent and expensive mops, and we never look back to see that the tap is open and the sink is overflowing. No one's turning off the tap.
That's really interesting. It's an interesting take because, so I hear a couple of different things. First of all, I'll go to the first point I'm going to make, which is, do you think the issue is the quality of food people are eating or the eating behavior? And what I mean by that is how much people are eating, what kind of food they are eating, not the quality, but like they're choosing to eat certain foods over others. Is it our eating behaviors or like a food addiction, for example, that is triggering the problem? Or is it that food has changed? We rely more on GMOs, for example. You know, we don't have the same resources we did years and years ago. Is it a combination? Is it quality? Is it the eating behaviors? What's the issue with the food?
Yeah. The way I see it, and because I see my patients struggle with this day in and day out, is that we live in a dysfunctional food environment. We are surrounded by hyperpalatable, calorie-dense, nutrient-poor foods that are made to be addictive, frankly. They are cheap, they're widely available, and they're advertised to us nonstop. What could go wrong? And I think what we're seeing is this is what can go wrong. Our health is in the balance.
Dr. Elizabeth Clotus is here, and she's an expert source in talking about this new study, which really the big alarming thing here is that we're seeing a massive uptick in heart disease, and we're seeing a huge uptick in the risk factors. We're projecting that we're going to see more people with diabetes, for example, or with obesity issues in America if we don't do something. So here's another question I have, because this was the second part of my thought. You had mentioned pill use. You said a lot of people will rely on pills. Do you mean like supplements? What do you mean pills? Or do you mean like where people will get on diet pills? Is that what you're talking about?
No. I mean, you know, medications. So medications like Lipitor and Crestor for high cholesterol.
I
mean beta blockers, calcium channel blockers, diuretics, et cetera, for high blood pressure. So we are in medicine, we are very busy prescribing medications, whereas what we should really be doing is helping our patients eat better. Because if you don't solve the root cause of the problem, if you don't address that, you won't ever cure anything. All you will do is cover up the effects of the cause. And people, I want to make a really important point. People think, and we've led them to believe to some extent, that you have to be, you know, a yoga practicing vegan triathlete to have any hope of addressing any of these health conditions, right? High cholesterol, high blood pressure, diabetes, excess weight, with lifestyle. That it has to be, it's an all or none thing. And it's absolutely not the case. I mean, one of the reasons why I founded Step One Foods was to prove that even a tiny dietary change can have marked impact on health in a very short period of time. I mean, one of the things I see actually is patients who can't take statins, you know, cholesterol medications, because they've developed side effects, or you know, they just don't want to be on yet another pill. And so we have to find a different way to approach this. And so I developed a food approach. And, you know, and all it takes is a couple of exchanges, you know, two little snacks a day. Literally, that's it. You don't have to, you know, start eating salads all day long, or, you know, or completely eliminate meat. All of those things would be great. But even if you just get started with a tiny change, what we showed with a, you know, in a trial with Mayo Clinic is that you can see 9% on average LDL or bad cholesterol reductions in 30 days. In 30 days, in 1 month with food, some people saw 20, 30, close to 40% LDL reductions. Again, with food, right? Mm-hmm. We think all that our only option is drugs, and that's not the case. Even tiny dietary adjustments can have huge impact. And we eat every day, multiple times a day. A tiny modification of that has huge downstream effects. An apple a day, this is my favorite example to my patients, an apple a day, now keeps the doctor away, right? Seems like kind of inconsequential. And if you do it for one day, yeah, you haven't accomplished much. But if you do it every single day for a year, you will have consumed 3 bushels of apples. Right, like that's a lot of fiber, antioxidants, micronutrients, vitamins. And if that's in exchange for a bag of chips or, you know, a cookie you have in the afternoon, like,
that's a big deal.
That's a health transformation right there.
Mm-hmm. That's very true. Earlier this week, there was a new study released from the American College of Cardiology. It projects a very steep rise in all 4 cardiovascular risk factors starting in the year 2025, which is not too far away from here. And that includes things like diabetes and obesity. We're talking this morning to Dr. Elizabeth Clotus, who is a cardiologist, also an expert source to discuss this study and the risk factors. She also founded what's called Step One Foods, which is a program that is nutrition-based. It's scientifically approaching how we could better care for our heart health and just our general health overall. Dr. Clotus, I had a question because you were just talking about how we overindulge as Americans. How did that trend happen? How is it that everywhere else across the country, or across the globe, I should say, and the reason I know this is because I have friends who live in Africa, in Europe. My own sister-in-law is from South America. She's from Brazil. And they all know portion control. Like, they all know portion control. For some reason, We don't. I've only known massive helpings of food. And what's funny is, like, I grew up in an Italian household where, oh, you just keep eating, you eat. But it's funny because if you go to Italy, they don't give you those kinds of helpings. Like, sure, like, I've had sit-down meals at a family friend's house in Italy where they will offer, like, hey, we've made plenty for the village, but they don't give you a plate full of pasta in Italy. It's really something that is kind of an American thing that we do. And I'm wondering, how did we unfortunately jump on that trend? How did that become a thing here?
You know, that's a good question. there's probably ways to unravel it. I think one of the blessings and curses is that food is cheap in the U.S. I think from a budget budgetary perspective, we don't spend that much of our disposable income on food compared to other countries. I would also say that the lowest quality food is often the least expensive, right? It's much cheaper to eat processed foods than it is to eat organic, fresh fruits and vegetables and pasture raised, beef and et cetera. I think that's part of it, is that it's inexpensive. And, one of the ways I think restaurants and places that we purchase food, they lure us is to provide us large portions, and it doesn't cost them that much to make it. I think that's a factor.
Mm-hmm. So there are a couple of things that I pulled from what you just said that we could honestly use in our everyday. So first and foremost, it sounds like, kind of like farm fresh food, or going where, the ingredients are better quality. It's going to cost you more. But first of all, maybe that's a good thing. And I'm not saying I want to spend more money, but I'm saying that maybe if it costs you more, it means that you're not making massive helpings of food for every single meal, and you are able to portion control a little bit better. So that's the first thing I'm hearing, is there's kind of a twofer there, better quality food and portion control. But it sounds like the other thing, too, is just in general, just investing in better food. Like, we kind of cheap ourselves out a little bit. Like, we don't really budget for, hey, you know what? Maybe your grocery bill should be one of the bigger items on your budget every month. Maybe that should be the thing you're investing in, because as long as you are trying to cut corners, it's going to cost you. Like, you get what you pay for, sort of a thing. That's what I'm hearing from you.
Yeah. In the big picture, good food is not expensive. What's expensive is being sick. And expensive not just in what it costs you in insurance premiums and copays and deductibles and blah, blah, but expensive in terms of, your physical abilities, your emotional health, right? Your lifespan. So that investment in food is a huge one that pays massive dividends. And the other thing I would say is, it actually doesn't have to be massively expensive either. It's just how you fill your plate. Proteins like chicken and beef, et cetera, those are actually more expensive than things like broccoli and lettuce.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't mean you have to turn your whole world upside down and stop eating the things you love, but maybe change the proportion of what's on your plate. So instead of having chicken with vegetables, have vegetables with chicken. And then make the chicken slightly higher quality. It is a better meal from a health perspective. It's a lower calorie meal. It's a more nutritionally dense meal. And if you look at the people who live long well, they eat primarily a whole food plant-based diet. So they're eating a lot of greens and beans, nuts, seeds, fruits, vegetables, and grains, but in their whole and unprocessed form. So this doesn't have to be hugely expensive. It has to be thoughtful, though, because we have to be choosy. Like I said before, we live in a very broken food environment that is almost enticing us to do the wrong thing for our health.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. And we do live in a very influential, driven society. Isn't that the case? It's very, very true.
And, you know, when there's a new diet every day.
Oh, gosh,
and
yes.
Eat keto, you know, eat eggs, don't eat eggs. Oh, my God, you had a grapefruit. What were you thinking?
Oh, I know. Right? Like, yeah, how do you keep up? It's so true.
And what I would say to the listeners is the best dietary advice I've ever heard is 7 words long. And this withstands everything. It withstands the fads. It withstands the test of time. It mirrors what people who live long well is. And that is eat food, meaning eat real food, food that your great-grandmother would recognize as food. Right? She wouldn't recognize Mountain Dew. She wouldn't recognize Cheetos. She wouldn't recognize much of the fast food that is out there.
Mm-hmm.
Not too much. So don't stuff yourself. Mostly plants. Like, that's it. Eat food. Not too much. Mostly plants.
I love that.
That is the answer.
That's quite the, I really like that. I'm going to keep that in the back of my brain as well. And I love that. We got to connect with you, Dr. Elizabeth Clotas, who's a cardiologist, also the founder of Step One Foods. And if you want to learn more, you also can go to steponefoods.com. Dr. Clotas, thank you so much for the time this morning. I really appreciate it.
It was my pleasure. It was great talking with you, Melissa.
Thank you. You too. Dr. Elizabeth Clotas here on WICC.
It's time to get up and get moving. Workout Wednesday. Melissa in the morning on WICC 600.
So during lunchtime earlier this week, I saw a new AP News article showing that new research is hinting that even a simple exercise routine could help older Americans with mild memory problems. So this just screamed Workout Wednesday. Joining us now is Amy Linus, who's our workout guru. She is our health coach, our wellness coach here on WICC. Good morning, Amy. How are you?
Good morning, Melissa. I'm doing quite well. How about yourself this morning?
You know, I can't complain. And I was really encouraged to hear this news. And I wanted to dive into it a little bit with you because, as you and I both know, we are we love our exercise. It's something that we do on a daily basis, a weekly basis. And I'm encouraged. And I even think if you are an older listener this morning, this could be a real game changer. Could you talk a little bit about this?
Oh, without a doubt, it is so true. Because let me just explain something, too. As we get older, our body mass index just increases if you're not training or working out. So with that comes some issues, and you put yourself at risk for a lot of brain fog, a lot of, like, Alzheimer's, things like that. And here is the reason. The carotid arteries are major blood vessels in the neck. They supply, like, blood to the brain, the neck, the face. And there are two. You have one on the right and one on the left. And what happens is, as your body mass increases and you go to sleep at night, your body's working a lot harder. Those carotid arteries are working a lot harder to get oxygenated blood flow to your brain. So with that restricted blood flow to your brain, you're going to have some deterioration, some brain fog, possibly even set yourself up for being at risk for Alzheimer's and things like that. So it's super, super important to make sure you're working out, taking good care of your body, keeping your body mass index in the right range.
So it's really interesting that they looked at this. So really quick to give people some background, researchers recruited about 300 older adults who basically didn't have much physical activity in their routine, and they had what's called MCI, mild cognitive impairment. Now, this is a condition that sometimes, not always, it could be the precursor to Alzheimer's. And what they found was they gave half of them aerobic exercise, and the other had stretching and balance kind of movements that they did to just raise their heart rate a little bit. And what they found was, after a year, the cognitive testing showed overall neither group had any worse symptoms. They stayed the same. They literally stayed the same. They didn't get any worse. It didn't, you know, progress in any way, which is a great sign. Now, what I find interesting about that, Amy, is for a long time, we always had the understanding of exercise your brain to avoid things like this, like doing crossword puzzles or reading and things like that. I have never heard of physical activity having a direct link with this kind of, of MCI. I've never heard this before.
Yeah. I know, it's crazy, but it actually does. And the reason for that was what I was explaining before about the carotid arteries. And, you know, they supply that blood to the brain, neck, and face as you're sleeping at night. So whenever that's restricted, say your body mass index is higher, it is if you're not working out and taking good care of yourself, then you have all that restricted blood flow to that brain. So yes, you can have a MCI and all these other issues start up and start to impair you during the day as we get older. So you're right, Melissa. I am so on board with this article, and I'm so happy that we were able to educate your listeners and explain the benefits of a little bit of exercise every day.
And like I said, Amy, we're talking to Amy Linus this morning, who's our wellness coach. And what I think is also interesting is that half the group did aerobics and the other half did like a stretching and balance, so almost more like a yoga or Pilates. And I think it's interesting that they both basically had the same results, which means that you could do basically anything.
Right.
It's just keeping your body moving.
Yes, without a doubt. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It is so important. And I tell everyone all the time, like weightlifting, exercise, cardiovascular training, eating a balanced diet. Those are all those are fountains of youth right there. Natural fountains of youth.
Yeah, that's so true. Now, Amy, what is your recommendation? If we have listeners right now who, let's just say, they either never step foot in a gym, or they are just not really active. Maybe they take a walk on occasion, but really they're just not very active because they either are retired or maybe they are going through something in their lives. What would be a first step? What would you recommend for somebody who essentially doesn't really do a lot of physical activity?
So I would suggest to start with something that you don't hate. Start with something you don't despise.
It's a good idea.
If you live near a beach or an ocean or shoreline or lake somewhere, you know, walk around that area a little bit. You know, give your mind a little bit of breathing and calming first thing in the morning or in the afternoon or whenever you're having your busiest, you know, time of the day, whenever you're most, like, anxious. Take 5 minutes to go out there and kind of do something that you don't particularly hate, you know, because then it becomes something you enjoy and you can build upon that.
It's very true. I mean, even when you join, you know, like something that's become apparently very popular is like pickleball for some reason. It is very popular for an understandable reason.
Uh-huh.
But like racquetball, things like that. I have noticed that seniors, more and more seniors are getting into, you know, and tennis has always been popular. Golf has always been popular. But like that was a thing I can remember my grandparents were really into, you know, staying active well into their 80s until they physically couldn't anymore. Now, what if you're somebody who was active? Okay. What if you were active? However, maybe you have now arthritis. Maybe you are wheelchair bound.
Right.
Maybe you are just can't do the things you used to do, because that also is very hard for some people. I have people who I know in their 60s and 70s who they were active their whole lives, but now they had back surgery, for example, or maybe they've got bad knees, or maybe they've gone through a surgery, or maybe they just have horrific arthritis. That's a very common thing. What would you suggest for them?
Stay mobile, and the things that you learn in physical therapy, keep those added in. Those aren't the best. We don't enjoy them per se, but they are there for a reason, and they will help us to stay mobile and active and to help us continue to recover. Because, you know, when you stop doing something and you become so sedentary, that arthritis is going to get even worse and going to make you feel so much worse than if you just kind of move through it slowly and gently at your own pace.
Amy, if people want to connect with you, they want to learn more, maybe they want to also get on board with a new health plan or supplement plan, how do they contact you? How do they find you?
Oh, that would be wonderful. You guys can find us at www.fitbodyvibe.com, fitbodyvibe.com. We are also under Fit Body Vibe on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube.
And if people want to read the article that Amy and I are referring to, when I put Amy's segment up on the podcast later today, I will also attach this article underneath it. Amy, thank you so much. I really appreciate having you on this morning.
Yes, thank you, Melissa. It's always a joy with you.
Oh, you too, my friend. Thank you so much. That's Amy Linus here on WICC. Every month we get to check in with the American Red Cross, the Connecticut chapter. And this morning we've got John Godin back on the show with us. What's going on, John? How are you?
I'm doing well, Melissa. Thanks for having us again.
Yeah, absolutely. Love having you guys on. I'm fine. Thank you so much for asking. I appreciate it. I know for the seventh consecutive year, national reports are showing for hurricane forecasts, we're going to have another above normal Atlantic hurricane season. So weather experts, they're saying there could be as many as 6 major hurricanes this year and up to 21 named storms, I should say. So how do we prepare best according to the Red Cross? How should we be preparing for hurricane season?
Well, it's like everything else. What we like to tell people during storm season is hope is not a plan. So we encourage everyone to plan for storms like these. So some of the things you do is you create an evacuation plan for you, your family. Where will you go if a named storm approaches you? And also, do you have an emergency kit put together? So, for instance, items that would be in an emergency kit would be a gallon of water per person per day, non-perishable food items, flashlights, battery-powered radio, and as I tell everyone, make sure you have a cell phone charger nearby or a power bar. In case you lose power, you can always plug your cell phones into those. But
so,
be informed.
I was going to say, should we be putting this packet of stuff together now? Like, should we be doing it as early as today?
What we like to say is make sure you have it on hand. So if a storm is approaching, say, 24, 48 hours in advance, it's there, it's available. You don't have to run to the store right before the storm. So I would encourage people to have that on stock so that you can pull it out in the event a storm is approaching.
It makes a lot of sense. And John, I didn't mean to cut you off. You were saying that we should also stay informed. Are there resources that you could find this on the Red Cross website or the app?
Well, we have our Red Cross app gives you the availability to get storm updates and also where shelters are available. God forbid if a storm does hit and you need to go there. That's one of the best ways to stay informed. Another way to stay informed is to make sure that you are aware of what your local municipality will be using to communicate with residents, because they'll tell you also what their preparedness looks like for any approaching storm.
We're talking this morning to John Godin, who is with the American Red Cross Connecticut chapter. And if you guys need help with disasters when it comes to volunteers, is there a way that people can sign up? And what are some of the different avenues that people can go if they want to work with the Red Cross?
Yeah, there's three major areas that we encourage people to volunteer for. We have a strong need for folks to work in shelters. So these are individuals that help welcome and register residents that come to one of our shelters. They help serve meals. They set up cots. They set up the actual shelter itself, distribute blankets, hygiene kits. These are individuals that you see on the front lines should you have to evacuate and go to a Red Cross shelter. The other thing we do is we encourage licensed healthcare professionals to volunteer for the Red Cross if they have time. So we're talking about RNs, LPNs, EMTs, paramedics, even physicians, because what they can do is they can use their unique medical skills to help residents who may be in a shelter and may have specific healthcare needs where they need some advice. The third area, and I think we talked about this in the past, and I always stress this with folks in the area in Connecticut, is we always need help for what we call disaster action team volunteers. The acronym we use is a DAT volunteer. These are the individuals that respond to home fires in our state. And I think we've talked about this before. We respond as a Red Cross in Connecticut to about 2 home fires a day. Mm-hmm. So we need individuals that can respond to those fires in the middle of the night to help guide people to shelter or supplies that they may need should they lose their home or lose their place of residence. Those are the three needs that we have.
Okay, so if people want to volunteer, John, where do they go?
They can go on to our redcross.org online. They can use our Red Cross app. And they can also call 1-800-RED-CROSS. But if you go to our website, there's a specific section on volunteers. You drop down on that volunteer. You put in a kind of an application in there. And someone will contact you, interview you, and will identify what your skills are versus what our needs are. that make sense?
It does. It absolutely does. Yeah. So again, the website is redcross.org. And if you want something specific, redcross.org/volunteer today. We're talking to John Godin, who's with the American Red Cross Connecticut chapter. And to switch gears a little bit, John, the American Red Cross has faced a concerning drop in blood and platelet donations this summer. Donors are really needed to make an appointment. Can you give us the very latest on the blood emergency that we're dealing with here and across the country?
Yeah, our red blood supply has shrunk by about, our donations have shrunk by about 20% this summer.
Oof.
This is somewhat typical during the summer. People don't donate blood as their first thought when a lot of folks are on vacation. People are in airports. People are on the roads. People are at trains. People are seeing family. People are going on long vacations that they were not able to go on because of the pandemic. And what we encourage people is the need for blood always is there, and we're encouraging folks to donate during the month of August. They have a chance, go in, register on the Red Cross blood donor app, 1-800-RED-CROSS, or on a website. Schedule time to give blood. It's important right now, because until September rolls around and the vacation season's over, we're always going to have fewer people available to donate.
John Godin is here, who's with the American Red Cross Connecticut chapter. And if you missed the news yesterday, New York's blood center announced a blood emergency. And hospitals and patients who are relying so much on the flow of donors, unfortunately, are not getting it in the summertime. And John, you were kind of touching on this a little bit. You were saying that in the summertime, people are traveling, they're busy. Essentially, they're out of routine. You know, kids are out of school, people's work schedules are different. Maybe they're going on vacations or taking their time off, or they're catching up from the pandemic. So I really want to spend the next few minutes convincing a listener right now who's out of routine, who's thinking it's fine, it's not my problem, that it is their problem, and that they should really think about going and donating blood sometime this month. So first of all, where is the blood supply at right now? Where do we stand here in Connecticut? Like, what level are we at?
Well, the donation level for this summer is down about 20%. We always try to keep the blood supply on a, what we call a five-day basis. So in other words, we always have to keep a five-day supply of blood. I don't know exactly where we stand with that, particularly today, but what we try to do is anticipate the needs that we're going to have over the next 2 to 3 months. Right now, we're not getting enough product in to meet what the anticipated needs would be. Remember, the last couple times I've said this, every 2 seconds, someone in this country needs blood. I've been on this phone for just shy of 20 minutes. That's 600 people, right? What we encourage folks to realize that giving blood is the gift of life. You cannot manufacture blood. We synthetically cannot manufacture blood. Biologically, it just doesn't happen. So what we want people to think about is, God forbid, if you have a family member that needs it, like my dad has once needed it before, you want to make sure that individuals think about that and set aside an hour to an hour and a half of their time in a 1 month period to give that pint of blood.
John, I could be far off, but as I mentioned in the top of this interview, we talk to the American Red Cross once a month, every month. I believe the last time I talked to you guys, I think it was Jocelyn who came on, so apologies. She said we are at a 1 to 2 level, a 1 to 2 day level. And I think you had said the average should really be about 5. Would you say we're probably still at that 1 to 2 day level, just to give people an idea?
I don't know for sure, Melissa, because I don't look at the inventories of blood. I would suspect we're below 5 days.
Okay.
If we're having an appeal, we would be.
Okay.
Remember back in, I think I was speaking to you back in February or March, we were at 0.5 days.
Yes,
right?
I remember that. That was critical.
And
yes,
remember that.
Yes, of course. Yeah.
And a lot of what was going on is there was a lot of demand at that time for blood products, and we couldn't keep up with that demand. Now, the issue is more supply, because folks are on vacation. It's a balance, we always have this balance with making sure supply equalizes demand, but you can't, it's hard to predict demand because you don't know how many elective surgeries are happening. You don't know what's happening in a particular communities that we provide blood to the hospitals that serve communities. You don't know what's happening from a health perspective in those communities. All we try to do is keep a certain level to account for contingencies and needs as they arrive.
Right.
Our major need right now, Melissa, is for O negative blood.
Because that's the universal.
Folks who have O negative.
Sure.
That's correct. So if you're in an ER and, God forbid, you're injured in an accident or have cancer treatments and need a blood transfusion, if we are unaware of what that individual's blood type is, we give them O negative. If you are an individual with a positive blood type, that's universal across all positive blood types, so A positive, O positive. So that's kind of things to remember, but that need for O negative, it is the universal blood supply. That is what we give in ER situations, mm-hmm. or healthcare providers give in ER situations, not myself. I am not a healthcare provider.
No, but we do appreciate that you give information consistently here on the show. So, again, if people want to, they want to register, they want to either give blood or they want to host a blood drive maybe at their churches or at their schools or in their communities. How do they do that, John? What's the website one more time?
If they want to give blood, there's three ways. Red Cross Blood Donor app. That's what a lot of people use if they have their smartphone. Red Cross Blood, redcrossblood.org is another one if you want to use the website. And those who just want to call to make an appointment, 1-800-RED-CROSS.
All right. John Godin, really appreciate having you on the show. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Melissa, for having us.
Absolutely. Always will. And, of course, the Red Cross comes on once a month, every month, here on WICC. So we'll, of course, check in with them in September, see how we're doing. Again, if you want to donate, certainly the time is now. Don't believe for one second that this isn't something that could or does impact you. As you heard John mention before, a lot of times it's people who are in trauma situations. Those are situations that you don't expect. Things like car accidents, freak accidents, a kid falling, something like that. If you or your child needed the blood immediately, that is nothing that anybody really plans for. Trauma can happen to literally anyone, and blood is needed for anyone in a trauma situation, just to give you an idea. So certainly think about that as you go throughout the rest of August, before we get back to school and back to routines. Think about taking a day and donating blood this summer.